I wanted to stay there about 10 more minutes. My debt to the choir is enormous. I am a creature of moods, and they put me in the right mood Sunday after Sunday. Larry Jones wondered what the difference would be between your coming an hour late and your having come an hour early last fall. The difference is that if you come an hour early, you have to wait around for an hour and then hear the sermon. If you come an hour late, you have the joy of missing it altogether. That's a big difference. If you are visiting this morning, I need to explain that this is the 10th in a group of sermons about the life of Christ. The series will end on the morning that marks the beginning of the Christian faith on the day we call Easter. But there would have been no Easter Sunday if Jesus had not made his final journey into the city of Jerusalem. And so it's that memorable trip into town that I invite you to think about this morning. Listening, as you have a way of doing, as if it were absolutely fresh and new. Toward the end of March, in that far-off time, Jesus realized that he was in great danger from the guardians of orthodoxy and public order, hated equally as a prophet and as a disturber of the peace. His enemies were saying, "What are we going to do? If we let this man go on, given his popularity, everybody will come to believe in him, and then the Romans will march in and punish the city for allowing such disturbances." And in all fairness, they had a point. Time after time already, some fanatic had stirred up the people, only to bring on a bloody reprisal from the empire. 2,000 Jews were crucified by the Roman Varus, and only 40 years later, the whole city of Jerusalem would be destroyed when the patience of Rome finally wore out. So it isn't fair to think of the enemies of Christ as monsters. From their point of view, he was a menace to both religion and the state, and I am sure that some of us would have voted as they did. So Jesus knew as he walked into town how grave the danger was. He tried to explain to his disciples what might happen, but they had their own private dreams, and what he said to them did not seem to register. The two brothers, James and John, jealous perhaps of Simon Peter's leadership, came to him with naked ambition. "When you come into your new kingdom, we'd like the two most important jobs, please." It must have been heartbreaking for Jesus to know, even at that late date, how terribly they had misunderstood what he had tried to teach them. But with amazing patience, he tried once more to explain his upside-down kind of kingdom. "You know," he reminded them, "that the people who are thought of as great in the world are the ones who lord it over all the rest. But it is not to be that way in my kingdom. If you want first place in that kingdom, you take what some think is last place. You have to be everybody's servant. Well, it must have sounded about as silly and impractical to them as it sounds now to most of us. So on they walked, their feet kicking up little spurts of dust, murmuring among themselves about what he had said, almost invincible in their failure to catch on to what this man meant, whom they loved so much. Try to imagine a lovely spring morning on the road into the hilltop town of Jerusalem, the cool air filled with the scent of flowers and the fluting trill of larks, and how the great snow-white temple loomed ever closer. And then watch as Jesus makes a sudden, surprising decision. He requests a donkey to ride on, not because he is tired, but because he wants to make a symbolic gesture. According to Jewish prophecy, the Messiah would come into the holy city on a donkey, symbol of humility and the quiet life. And so Jesus deliberately decides to say, I'm the one who can save you from destruction if you will only choose with me the ways of gentleness and peace. He was pretty sure they wouldn't, but he wanted to make one more gesture to show that he wished to conquer by love and not by force. It must have been quite a sight to some of the Roman soldiers along the way who had seen victory parades in their own country with the marching legions in perfect order, the flags of empire flying everywhere, and the miserable captives stumbling along behind in chains. Some of those soldiers must have roared with laughter at the sight of this country bumpkin with his legs dangling from the donkey's sides almost to the ground, and all those wild shouting Israelites running along in front and on both sides, dropping their clothes on the road to make a red carpet welcome and throwing tree branches down to make a highway of leaves. There cannot have been many scenes quite like it in the history of the world, especially with a chief character who knew so well that the howling crowds did not understand any better than his dearest disciples what he wanted to give them, and who knew that if he disappointed them, they would within a day be screaming with equal excitement for his death. They wanted a Messiah, but they were all mixed up about the kind of Messiah he meant to be. They wanted a military savior, but he knew what was going to happen to them if they kept infuriating the Roman army. And suddenly, as he looked at the gleaming white walls of the temple Herod had built, the image of what lay ahead for his people filled his eyes with tears. Actually, the word Luke uses is even stronger. It hints that his composure was shattered, and that he actually sobbed openly. If only you had known, He said to no one in particular and to everyone, "If only you had known on this great day the way that leads to peace. For a time will come when your enemies will set up siege works against you. They will hem you in at every point, bring you to the ground, you and your children within your walls, and leave not one stone standing on another, because you did not recognize God's moment when it came." We have to translate that curious phrase, God's moment. And you may have a different sense, but this is what I hear. I have ridden into this city on the humblest animal I could find, trying one last time to teach you that the way of peace is your only hope. But I see our dreams are not alike. I want for every person a kingdom of love in the heart, which can sustain life no matter what happens to systems or governments. But what you want is a violent revolution so that you can be proud again and lord it over the ones who have oppressed you. But you will lose, children of this holy city. You will be destroyed because you could not recognize in me the one idea that would have saved you. It turned out, by the way, to be quite as bad as he feared on this day it would be. The Romans finally got tired of the implacable hatred and all the little guerrilla uprisings and sent their armies marching into Palestine to create a nightmare with almost no parallel in history. Starving from the siege, women killed, cooked, and ate their own babies. When Titus finally got into Jerusalem, he stripped the priests naked and threw them to wild animals. He desecrated the glorious temple with its fragrant cedar and its rich overlay of gold and killed the desperate believers who clung to its altars until the temple courts ran ankle deep in blood. When he set fire to the wooden parts of their sacred building, Jewish men and women, hysterical at their loss, jumped into the flames. Thousands who survived were crucified for a joke on crosses that stretched, some witnesses say, for miles around the city. More than 1 million died. I can still remember vividly how I found in a church library when I was 13 a copy of The History of the Jews by Josephus, and how I read these terrible things sitting unnoticed in the back of my father's furniture store, fascinated to be reading a religious book filled with so many horror stories. You can understand now why he wept, this Jesus of Nazareth who loved his people and the sacred city and had seen in his mind a preview of what was going to happen to it. They were rejecting the only philosophy that could possibly save them, and there was nothing he could do about it. It must have been quite a relief to the nervous civic leaders who were watching him that day to see him cry. We are told by Luke that the chief priests and lawyers were bent on making an end of him with the support of the leading citizens, but found they were helpless because the people all hung upon his words. But when he wept, they must have felt a little better. This was not a man acting like a conqueror. Not much to worry about from a man whose only moment of triumph dissolves into heartbreak. They would know how to be practical when the time came, even if this dreamer didn't. And certainly over the short span of events, they were right and he was wrong. As he drew near the temple itself on this final journey of his mortal life, he saw the same things happening that had made him so angry before. Religion turned into a business. Money changing hands. Poor people being overcharged and tricked. The noise of sharp and greedy voices haggling over prices. Animals bellowing in the holy place. His temper put a corded whip to work. He struck right and left to clear a path, bowled over tables, scattered shekels on the paving. This was not a man trying to slip into town. And in little knots, watching him, his enemies said, "You see, nothing has worked. The whole world has gone after this man." It was showdown time, and on both sides, everybody knew it. Jerusalem was not, in some ways, a very happy place for Jesus. He was a country boy, a stubborn and radical prophet from the hill country up north, and the big city keepers of orthodoxy and managers of the temple did not trust him. He had gotten along rather well with the good people of Galilee, but around Jerusalem, his teaching was much too radical, and his right to teach at all was called into question. When did a prophet ever come out of Galilee? His enemies sneered. Like some sophisticated New Yorker saying, "He's from Kansas, for God's sake, what can you expect?" People who followed Jesus were razzed as Galileans too. Hicks and rednecks who couldn't tell a prophet from a palm tree. There are plenty of signs that Jesus preferred the country, loved to walk and pray in the tranquil serenity of low hills and lush meadows, that the arrogant and greedy priests made the temple precincts disagreeable to him. One day, some of his disciples wanted him to notice the beauty of the temple, the rich offerings that covered the walls, and his response startled them. He said, "You see these buildings? There will not be one stone left on another." He could already hear the trampling feet of Roman soldiers 40 years off yet in the future. He refused to admire anything about their great church, except a poor widow who passed by just then and threw a small coin into the collection box. "She has given more than the whole lot of them," he said. "Because what they give out of big bank accounts, Out of her dire poverty, she has put in everything she has. This criticizing the rich, praising the poor, blaming the opulent priesthood didn't make him very popular. The one thing he absolutely could not stand, had no patience with for a moment, was hypocrisy. The longest and most violent speech he ever made starts out, "Woe unto you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites," and then catalogs their pretense and greed and lack of compassion in one of the most blazing indictments in all history. The whole temple corruption made him so angry that he blurted out one day, "I will destroy this temple that is made with hands, and within 3 days I will build another made without hands." No one knows exactly what he meant. The old interpretations I was given no longer make much sense to me. I think he meant, "My teaching will put an end to this kind of worship. God is a spirit. They that worship him will worship him in spirit and in truth, not on this hill, in the crush and noise of commerce, but in the shrine of quiet hearts." Gorgeous cathedrals and temples will not be a requirement. They may even at times get in the way. And so he has come into town for the last time, unwilling to compromise, unwilling to shut his mouth to save his skin. "How great you are," the fickle crowds said that day long ago in Jerusalem, but with no idea what they meant or in what his greatness might truly lie. And before their simple ignorance, he bowed his head and wept. And within a few more hours, found his way to an upper room for one last meal with his closest friends, where next week, in our recreation of his life, we shall hear them talk around the table.